Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. We have a new guest on today, Lawrence Burdan, and he is a paramedic that has some unique experiences, and I don't want to take away too much from it. So, Lawrence, can you introduce yourself real quick?
Hello, everyone. I'm Lawrence Burdan, and I am a paramedic in both North and South Carolina. I've worked for a variety of different agencies, high volume, rural systems, and I'm actually a critical care paramedic as well. So pretty well diverse background. I tend to try to focus on being the best paramedic I can be and try to dive into further education. And here I am today.
And one of the things that I found interesting is you work in just the right spot. We actually cross some state lines as well. Which states do you work in?
I work in North and South Carolina.
Okay. So obviously you've had some weather going on recently. How's that been?
Absolutely. It's been trying. We didn't get hit as hard as I thought we would in actually both my areas in which I work. However, just getting a lot of rain, and we're getting another hurricane actually coming. It's actually forecasted to touch down in our areas again tonight and tomorrow as well.
Oh, geez. Well, so stay safe out there, but we weren't here to talk about the weather. That just kind of comes up naturally, but we are here to talk about something that I found a very unique subject, and we're going to talk about a little bit of your connection with it too, if you don't mind, but pediatric neurological emergencies, especially pediatric strokes, it's kind of a nuanced thing. We don't really get to talk about it much in general, but the literature is somewhat limited on this, but there's some things out there. So I guess, Lawrence, talk about a little bit, if you don't mind, about what made you interested in this topic in the first place.
So on the pediatric side, well, if I would rewind, the first stroke victim in my family was actually my grandmother, and that actually what got me into the neurological emergencies in general. And I kind of feel like I don't want to say neglected. I want to say it's maybe not addressed as fruitfully as it should be in the EMS world. I mean, we do the identification and preparation for treatment, things like that in any realm. But nonetheless, pediatrics became a case for me because my son, approximately about a year and a month ago to date, suffered from two strokes actually, and his strokes were secondary to renal hypertension. And so I look at it and at the total case and the two parts, in my opinion, that people get scared of the most as well as neurological, and the second is pediatric. So that was really my driving force to really focus and look at this and really get more in-depth study on the neurological emergencies or pediatrics.
And again, this is a really challenging aspect, and we're going to talk more about this as we dive into the different sections. But I think one of the things, and this is one of your first points as the outline that you built in talking about this conversation, is that this is very time dependent. And a big thing that happens is that a lot of times this gets missed initially by EMS because we're trying to do our standard procedures and our usual things that we're trying to get done, like establishing IV access and doing the stabilizing measures. But there's something that we very easily miss. And this happens also in hospital. So this is not just an out-of-hospital issue. This is an in-hospital issue as well. And that's getting that history.
Absolutely. The history is so critical on this because, you know, if you're able to get it and a parent's around or if EMS is getting it from parents, sometimes the parents aren't there, whether they're at school or they're just playing on a playground. This history is pretty critical. The fact that the child or the parent or both may not be in the right state of mind to even provide you a solid history. And there's so many variables for the history as well that should be taken into consideration. But it's like, you know, as much as we're in a hurry, a critical point to treatment for definitive care is certainly that history. So the physician can treat the patient appropriately.
And that early recognition by EMS is huge. Again, the history plays a major part in that. Sometimes, you have that traumatic brain injury patient. Those are going to be the ones that are a little more obvious. In certain cases, they're more significant because, again, they're already going to be acting different. And some of that's going to be based on your physical. But the history, man, this is something that I cannot stress enough for anyone who's taking care of pediatric patients. The history is multifactorial and can really change your way of managing this patient. And especially sometimes on the hospital side, the parents may be coming, but they may not be there yet. It may just be EMS. It may just be whoever brought them in. You know, if it's a friend or a grandparent or something else, they may not know the rest of the story. So the history, man, and I cannot stress that enough, is the first part of the information that we need to get.
Absolutely. You know, Chip, I think that's a solid point too, when if the friend's bringing them in, or a babysitter, things like that. You know, I think a lot of ways we can do some deductive reasoning is some of the risk groups to consider that these children might fall in, or what their age groups are, you know, if they're playing sports or if they're traveling, a lot of different things that can possibly affect these things, particularly when it comes to TBIs.
Yeah, so let's talk about TBIs. Let's get in that, because that's a great category where, again, a lot of these historians may not be the parents. They may be the coaches or the friends or whatever.
Oh, yes. And the so if we subdivide TBIs, and I think this is important because it shows you the progress of where the injury actually is going, if you will. So if you've got mild TBIs and then a child, you know, especially it might look like a regular concussion sign or whatever the case may be. But the signs and symptoms typically you're going to see in children, you're going to see the blank stares, dizziness, nausea. They might have difficulty getting up, or just might be something simple like trouble doing homework and things like that. So some of these things that parents need to identify as well. And they're going to know best what's normal for their child better than we ever will. But nonetheless, I think it's important that that the symptoms, the faster they get identified, you can certainly see the path that the child may go down.
And something to help you try and identify patients as far as the significance of their traumatic brain injury is not only the physical that you can perform, but also the history with it. And in combination with clinical assessment tools, such as the PCARN algorithm. I really like the PCARN algorithm because it does a great job kind of help risk stratifying patients on whether or not they need a head CT. So how many kids come in because they bump their head and the parents are a little freaked out because they're acting a little different at first, but guess what? In a very brief period of time, they're back to baseline. Maybe they have something that's just a little off, but when you go through the PCARN algorithm, you've identified how low their risk is. And if it's exceedingly low, then you don't need to even monitor these patients for any significant time. You may just be able to discharge them home right away, or sometimes you may have to observe them versus doing a CT. And in some cases, when we have some more significant findings or certain factors in the history or physical that we're worried about, okay, maybe we need to go straight to CT with these kids.
Yes. And then, you know, and the other thing too, when it comes down to like behavior and what's normal, I think, you know, part of that is to not dismiss certain signs and symptoms as well. I know we'll touch more on this on the stroke stuff, particularly when I start referring to my son's case. But the, you know, if you have a child who's typically, you know, might have a blank stare in terms of what's abnormal to it. So they may typically do it, but is there something abnormal? And this, it goes back to history again. And, you know, we can't drive that point home enough. And I think that's critical in the history finding, just because in the same thing as we talked about trouble doing homework as well. And, you know, you don't want to dismiss these signs. But at the same time, we don't want to be running everyone through a scanner that doesn't need to be ran through a scanner as well.
Yeah. And it gets really complex because you may ask a parent, well, are they acting any different than their usual? And of course, they're going to say yes, but you have to then get into what makes it different than usual. So, you know, I'm a little more fussy and crying is something I get to see a lot at night, but it's also past that kid's bedtime by a couple of hours. So are they fussy and crying because they're still awake, or are they fussy and crying because they have something more serious going on? Those little questions, the little teasers to see what do you mean by this or that, can be very helpful in actually guiding the care.
Oh, absolutely. And then also, I think another good point too is where pediatrics defined. I found in the various agencies that I worked for, and a lot of my movement came from while I was traveling with the military and things like that. So I've got to see different protocols from different areas and then also function under them. And I think that when you see some follow the straight AHA guideline saying, it's, you know, signs of puberty. Some people say 16, some people say 17.
Talking about some of the more significant findings that we need to talk about in general when it comes to traumatic brain injuries before we move on to the, like the stroke cases. Again, these are the kids that we're more worried about if they're very confused or agitated. So again, like what we just mentioned, or they're really drowsy, very difficult to arouse. So this, again, you have to kind of focus on everything, but kids should not be difficult to arouse. They may be pissed off when you arouse them, especially when it's, you know, in the middle of the night and they're being checked for a head injury that happened. That, again, can be difficult, but especially if it's in the middle of the day where that kid should normally be awake, okay, that's more concerning. One of the ones is seizures. Seizures, I feel like, is one that in most cases we need to take very seriously. We especially do this pretty well in adults. Most of the time, if an adult has a seizure after a head injury, that's straightforward and done. But the seizures, I think, is a little more complex in pediatric patients because we also have other possible causes, such as febrile seizures.
Yes, and I think the febrile seizures, the takeaway on that as well is when you really differentiate between the simple and complex. So when you're talking to a parent, particularly a parent, or even anyone not attached to the medical field that can are going to basically describe something that's lasted for a week when you know it's only lasted for 10 seconds. And it's like the old theory, a little bit of blood looks like a lot of blood. And so I think that when you see the difference in the simple febrile seizures are typically from anywhere from a few seconds to even 15 minutes. And you're typically only going to see it about once every 24 hours versus your complex. They can be longer than 15 minutes and occur many more times throughout the course of the day. And so the seizure certainly is not a symptom that should be ignored. It could be a precursor to so many different things or so many things cause that possible seizure.
But one that's a little more tricky is vomiting, because again, this could be something that's a lot more serious. The way I think about it is they're vomiting more than twice. I'm really worried about it. Now, right now is basically gastroenteritis season, right? So a kid may already be vomiting. So I try and tease out, were they vomiting before or after the head injury? Did they have any episodes before the head injury? Is the vomiting still going on? Was it just basically right afterwards in a crying fit that they started to vomit and then they haven't vomited since then? That vomiting, a lot of people want to pull the trigger on as far as they need to do something. But again, teasing out with the history and maybe some observation versus going straight to CT can also be beneficial.
Absolutely. And I think vomiting is a very unique bear in itself. I mean, because vomiting could be nothing or it can be your worst nightmare. It just depends on why they're vomiting. You know, did they, like just like you stated with the gastroenteritis, or maybe they ate something bad, or maybe they're vomiting and it's just and it looks normal to them, which is sometimes a telltale sign of bad, worse things to come if they're vomiting and they're just going about their day. I think that's a it's particularly noteworthy to really focus on why they're vomiting if you have the opportunity to know, or if they just don't care that they're vomiting, because that obviously can also be some other underlying signs as well.
So what about a loss of hand and eye coordination?
I think with your children, which you're mostly going to see, most of us can appreciate this who have children, the typical tasks that you're going to see, whether tying shoes or unlocking doors, I say this loosely, or they're just being clumsy. I think let's say more clumsy than normal for your clumsy kids. That's where it's a normal for. I think that's something to it's an observation, because I think that most of the children, you know, when they learn to walk, obviously without any pre-existing conditions, you know, are typically going to be you're going to have a baseline or a normal. I think those are important observations to notice.
One trick to help with this too is you can ask the parents what their baseline would be. So are they already walking around? Are they doing certain tasks very easily, like grabbing at certain objects, stuff like that? If they can do those types of tasks on a baseline and then you have them try and do it there and they're doing it normally, that's reassuring for that hand-eye coordination issue. However, if they're not doing that, then you have to be a little more concerned. And one that I try and do with any kid that's walking is do a gait test. A gait test can tell you a lot of things that you won't get to see otherwise. And I do this both in adults and pediatric patients. I have them get up and I have them walk if at all possible. And you'd be surprised the number of times you can pick up on certain things like cerebellar strokes or bleeds that are affecting the posterior part of the brain and being able to pick that up a little more quickly by doing things like that.
Absolutely. There's, and I think it's important too, wherever the affected side is, you know, a child might be complaining of headaches, because the statistic shows that basically 50% of pediatrics present where their headaches at is where their injury likely occurred.
Big part of this is also going to be prevention. So the little things like actually wearing helmets and other protective equipment, I feel like is one of the many things that gets ignored by parents so often. I hate when I see kids who come in after, for example, a bicycle accident. I always like to ask them, were you wearing a helmet? And lo and behold, they usually aren't.
Oh yes. And then, you know, it's funny because especially when, at least for us in EMS, you're an eye of the public as well. And sometimes too, when you have the parent, you don't want to spend $1,200 when I can drive them up there myself or whatever their excuse may be. I think that's the time for the EMS. We call it teachable moments. And most people forget about that concept completely after they leave medic school, regardless of the type of program. But this is really a good opportunity to tell them the importance of it, because there's no such thing as a TBI-proof helmet. And I think that sometimes it's almost like if you hit your funny bone, it's not real funny when you hit it, but when you hit you got to hit your elbow just right, and then you feel it. Well, the head's no different. If you hit it just right, something that small as a minimal fall could really certainly be catastrophic. And I think the other thing I think we kind of ignore, and especially when you have some of these children's events and you see the parents are, it almost seems like you feel like they're gambling a little bit, but I think the children understand the rules of the sports, because we can say this till we're blue in the face, rules are there for a reason. And some of the rules are established there to prevent injury and as well. So I think it's important for parents as well as coaches to really make sure that children understand these things.
So we've covered TBI pretty well. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about stroke.
So stroke, I think that stroke is it certainly has not got the attention as MIs have. However, it's starting to gain momentum, which is important for recognition. Everyone has seen the campaign for FAST and a lot of the different identifications. But I think there's some important numbers to look at, especially for the people who have had the unfortunate occurrence of dealing with strokes in any loved one, but much less a child, and the rarity of it. So basically, your strokes, you're looking at happen about 1 in 4,000 live births. And when you look at the actual risk of stroke from birth through 18, you're only looking at about 11 in 100,000 children who actually suffer from these. And of these 11 children, the most common are in children under the age of 2. So certainly in the circumstance of my child was even more rare, because it happened to him at 7. So, and the higher risk are certainly boys and children of any African descent as well. They are certainly at the highest risk for stroke.
And so let's talk about some of the actual risk factors that we'd be looking at.
Risk factors for stroke that I think that we see most common in adults. You're looking at high blood pressure, irregular heartbeat, arteriosclerosis, and all these things are rare in children, but they're real. It's a real possibility. I think with children, I think when we start focusing on whether it's a condition, whether they're dealing with something like Alagille, or if they're dealing with any renal issues to where the renal hypertension comes in, or any other kind of vessel type problems, it's some of those things that you really should look at, because hypertension is not it's not normal really in anybody, but it happens. And in my opinion, based on dealing with it as well as a provider, I find that blood pressures, and as easy as they are and as fast as you can get one done, are sometimes people are like, oh, they're not accurate in children. You know, some say, you know, it's 3 and older or whatever the case may be. If you can get one and that's an appropriate sized child, I think it's important, because you start identifying the high blood pressures. You know, if you have urine output issues or energy issues. And obviously all those things are pointing at renal, because these are the typical things that you're going to see with the children. And I think what we talked about before, the seizures are going to be a great precursor to see if you have to look further, and just as we talked before, they might be getting scanned in order to look for some of these other issues. And I think, and to really dive in more specifically, if you look at congenital heart defects like aortic stenosis or atrial septal defects, or the patent ductus arteriosus and patent foramen ovale.
A couple other common ones to talk about that you really have to consider, especially in certain patient populations. I feel like one of the big ones is sickle cell disease. And this one, again, it's going to be population dependent, and there may be some history in the family of sickle cell that you need to keep track of. But sickle cell disease is a big one. Immune disorders is another common cause. Any blood disorders, blood clotting or hemophilia can, of course, play its own role as well. And we've talked about some of the others, such as certain types of disorders of the arteries. And I think that's what you said your son had, was that, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I believe, and there's still a whole bunch of testing, and obviously his actual stroke that happened has been more of a concern. So we're still under evaluation, but it's going to be a lot of stenosis. So if you have a lot of stenotic vessels throughout, it certainly can be an issue. In fact, they've even found more occlusion in his right carotid artery, but where angiogenesis has certainly worked wonders, it was able to reroute and still complete the circle of Willis to obviously keep perfusing his brain. And I think that it's certainly, again, you know, when you start looking at disorders such as moya and a vasculitis with some other people as well, they can be all predispositioned for the same thing. And keeping that circuit, if you will, or that circle of Willis completed, I think that's really important. That's what we're after if you have to deal with a stroke as well.
All right. And some others to consider would be trauma, especially at the head or neck. Infections like meningitis can definitely play a role. And then we have other random things such as the mother's history of infertility or infection or like premature rupture of the membranes or preeclampsia, all those types of things. And then, of course, because it's always that one that everyone mentions and then quickly unmentions it again because no one really wants to go into the detail behind it, but that's metabolic disorders.
Yes. And, you know, when you start looking at, I mean, because there's a lot, but, you know, metabolic disorders are certainly going to be, most of these are going to be rare. That's going to cause the neuroscience. But when you start looking at mitochondrial myopathy, encephalopathy, or lactate acidosis, these are some of the bigger ones that you're going to most commonly see. But I think I want to go back a little bit on what you were saying with the maternal infections and things like that. It goes back to recap what we said before. It's history, history, history. And I think it's with children, even if they're a few years old, to still ask mother if it was a full term, especially when, particularly like if they're 3, 4, 5 years old, you know, was a full term, or, you know, did they have any of those other symptoms or their premature rupture of the membranes or infection of amniotic fluid, just things like that, because that certainly can be ongoing. And it's just because their child has these conditions doesn't mean they know anything about it. To them, it's let's get them to the doctor, let's get them treated, let's go home. And then some parents are on the other way around, they might be able to teach you something about the condition.
All right. So what are some of the challenges when it comes to the assessment of these patients?
I think that assessing the children, particularly newborns or even really young children, are particularly challenging because, you know, if you look at the newborn, you know, they can't communicate their symptoms with you. And sometimes these symptoms or their communication, obviously, is not going to be readily accessible. So basically, as you're assessing things and you're starting to see things not normal. So if it looks like they're real weak on just one particular side. So basically, I'm not saying to harass these newborns. They just had a really big traumatic event happen to them, and just harassing a baby might not be good for mom later. But basically, I think one of the biggest things is how you're going to talk. When we look at the FAST outline that you typically see on TV, typically for adults, you know, we can change things up for a child. So if you're looking at, you know, F for facial palsy, it's going to basically remain the same, but you might have to tell a child to smile real big at you, or, you know, show me your teeth like a mean dog, or try to have fun with them, because the more comfortable you make them, the more they're going to trust you. With the arm weakness, you may be able to tell them to walk like a, or, you know, hold their arms out like a zombie, close their eyes, and But you're asking the child who's you've got to gain the trust on to close their eyes with the stranger. And again, these are things for consideration. Speech, it depends on the child. Some kids can't talk anyway. And also, but as the child gets older, you don't want to be that lame guy treating the child anyway, because they might just look at you like you have two heads as well. And time of occurrence, that just stays pretty generic. But I think one of the really cool things as well is some assessment guidelines such as SPAS are awesome, but to add other things to it is also fitting as well. So if you add, let's say be fast, a B and an E, you can say B would be begin with balance with unstable coordination. We talked about that a little bit in our TBI section. And then E would be eyes. So you're looking at symptoms of diplopia, or they can't see out of one eye, or any symptoms such as that. But I think one of the biggest takeaways at that point as well is you can find all these things, and it is 100% a stroke, and every area is going to be different. But there are some medical centers that do not acknowledge code stroke for pediatrics. So I think it's also good knowing what kind of hospitals you're dealing with as a provider. Because I think that's pretty important to understand what you can actually call. But it doesn't take away from identifying these symptoms. But I think it's important in terms of stroke teams and other capabilities at the hospitals that you work at or driving to. I think it's important to understand.
All right. And let's talk a little bit about the actual symptoms that we maybe see, especially in the older kids that we can assess more thoroughly.
So a lot of symptoms you're going to end up seeing is you're going to see a lot of sudden onsets of sudden impaired vision, sudden numbness or weakness in the face, arm, or leg, particularly one side of the body, which is pretty sensible on our typical assessments. Difficulty speaking or understanding words. The difficulty speaking, again, we all know the normal speech patterns of our children as well. And difficulty swallowing. And I think difficulty swallowing is a very interesting concept as well after strokes too, when it comes to like swallow studies and things like that. So, hopefully these strokes didn't happen, that they were real small and now starting to appear and show themselves. And, hopefully the difficulty swallowing could subside. And then dizziness, loss of balance, or lack of coordination. We talked a little bit about that as well with the gait test. That's a really good idea, especially for, before you transport. And brief loss of consciousness or seizures. And sudden inability to move any part of the body. And these symptoms, so basically symptoms are going to differ depending on the affected part of the brain. So you're not going to see all of these. You might only see one. Maybe you'll see three. But seizures, nausea, and vomiting are very common in children. And so you certainly want a thorough assessment and thorough history to ensure you're ruling out what you got to rule out.
So like you said, I mean, this is something where you want to recognize this immediately, because there are treatments, just like for adults, there are treatments for children with stroke. We'll talk about that more here in just a minute. But failing to do this, failing to identify these patients and getting them the proper care they need can lead to some pretty significant long-term issues. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Some of the things that can be dealt with from failing to identifying these symptoms or the strokes for children and having a long-term effect, you start seeing unilateral weakness or paralysis of one side of the body. You have one-sided neglect, which causes the stroke survivor to ignore or forget about the weaker side. It sounds kind of strange to say someone can forget one side of the body, but when you're favoring one side just because it's easier, and I guess some people like to think of humans being naturally lazy creatures, so I think it's important with children that you really encourage them to use the other side. Difficulty with speech and language. Difficulty swallowing, decreased field of vision. A lot of people are going to find this and see progressive issues with this, as they go through eye doctors and things like that. A loss of emotional control or change in moods, some cognitive changes. They're not going to be able to remember as well. So a lot of the problems with memory, again, you will see with just simple things that they ordinarily did, were able to remember in the past. Judgment, problem solving, behavioral changes. And, you can really get in the weeds with behavioral changes, even personality changes is another issue. You really get in the weeds with a bunch of other issues as well, particularly when they're really young, when everyone's scared what could possibly be wrong, if anything at all, because we all want the best for our children. So improper language or actions. So if it's something like they're, look at signs of agnosia and things like that. I think there are some of the things that people might cause an outburst. I mean, that seems a bit outlandish, but these are possibilities, or just the development of epilepsy.
All right. So we've talked about the history, getting a good early assessment, recognizing what needs to happen, and identifying the appropriate like signs and symptoms and stuff like that. So now that we've done all that, now we have a high suspicion for a significant concern for stroke. Now let's talk a little bit about the actual treatment.
So treatment, when it comes down to treatment, we'll call it what it is. Most of your treatment's going to be done at home. You wait where, you know, the hospital and EMS, where we're going to stabilize and put people on the path of where they need to go. So the treatment of the many therapies that you have that are managed at home is going to be such things such as controlling your high blood pressure or supportive care to maintain normal body temperatures, particularly for generalized sickness, sepsis, or even possible neurostorms. Again, it all depends on parts of the brain that are affected. Ensuring proper hydration, blood sugar levels, you know, because your brain's the biggest robber of sugar in your body. And so really keeping a close look at your blood sugar levels are important. Seizure detections, typically in the hospitals, can be via EEG. And ordinarily, after most strokes as well, you're going to be on anticonvulsant medications as well, because it's a higher suspicion at that point that they can suffer from a seizure. So basically, they're going to be on those medications prophylactically until they can either wean them off or they're on them forever. You possibly be managing ICP. There might be a blood transfusion for children, particularly in sickle cell disease or antithrombotic therapy. And in antithrombotic therapy, you're really going to see generally in infants as more or less than you will on children. And then surgery as it relates to hemorrhagic stroke, really like the craniotomies to relieve pressure. Because some of the pressure, the swelling of the brain can certainly exceed capacity. So certainly after it happens, the aftercare is pretty critical because that bone flap cannot be in and obviously protecting it, whether it's with helmets or, they might be confined to bed. Again, it's just dependent on how bad the child's affected. And so some home remedies are not effective and sometimes are really a waste of money, such as overdoing electrolytes or drinking too much or too fast of food, a consumption of food or liquids. And it's really counterproductive to healing and really prevention. So a lot of children are sent home with food pumps or, you know, they have a constant infusion of their fluids and their electrolytes are really regulated, or they might have, you know, their magnesium's really regulated. Again, it just depends on the causation of the issue. So I think it's when you're at home and you look at what you're trying to balance and what is necessary for the child. It's you know, a lot of people say dehydrate, punish some Gatorade or a lot of the sports drinks, and that's not always the solution.
I think the big takeaway from this is that there are tons of different treatment options, and that really that treatment gets tailored to what's going on at the time. So if family asks about that, usually I kind of have to push this off and just say, well, it depends on how the initial management goes, and then from there, the recovery process.
And some children, particularly on age, again, a lot of children are going to be real resistant. Or, you know, my son, his big thing is he absolutely doesn't want to talk about medicine because it upsets him. So there's certainly a balance of how you're going to do things and what's unique to them or, you know, their mood. And I think another thing too, Chip, I wish I didn't address it before, but I think one of the things too, people should really focus on, make sure the child dealing with these, particularly when they are in their 5, 6, 7, 8, when they're really used to functioning and maneuvering, make sure you're watching for depressive states and making sure they're not beating themselves up on little things because they can't do, and just make a really supportive and encouraging environment. Because, you know, we talked about the neural health, but, you know, we also got to remember about mental health as well.
All right, Lawrence, thanks for all that wonderful information. But before you go, anything else you want to cover?
I think that about wraps it, Chip. I appreciate you having me and letting me talk a little bit about the stroke, and want everyone to know to not be scared of pediatrics and really, really take the time to spend with them. You have to change it up a little bit, but I think kids need our help just as much as adults.
Sounds great. Well, before you go, can you give us the tagline, please?
Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.